I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. It's hoped a third drilled hole to vent poisonous gases from the Massey mine in Montcoal, Virginia, will help in the attempt to rescue four miners 1,000 feet below ground. Earlier today, workers tried to communicate with the miners by banging on a pipe and setting off small explosions on the surface to send a seismic signal. But the sister of one of the trapped miners told the Today Show they may not answer if they're able to get to a refuge tent. Well, Beth Voorhees of West Virginia Public Radio joins us. And Beth, 25 killed, four now trapped. What's the latest from officials there?
Well, in all of this tragedy, there's at least some good news to report. There were two survivors of the explosion. One survivor is doing very well. The other is in intensive care unit at a Charleston hospital. That miner's condition is not known at this time. As you say, they're drilling another hole. They're waiting for the mine to ventilate. They will send in rescue teams as soon as it's safe to do so. About 30 rescuers will spread out over two sections of the mine where they think these four men may be missing.
Well, a buildup of methane is being blamed for the explosion. Massey has been cited for aggressively contesting safety violations. Don Blankenship is the CEO. Recently, there were problems with the ventilation system that clears methane gas. He contested those. That's his right. But he himself is something of a lightning rod. Tell us a little more about him.
Well, Don Blankenship is well known in West Virginia, not only in mining circles, but also in political circles. Several years ago, during a campaign for a seat on the state Supreme Court, Don Blankenship provided $3 million to a group he called And for the Sake of the Kids. And he provided all this money to this group, and its purpose was to oust the Democrat who was running for re-election on the state Supreme Court. It worked. A Republican was elected and now sits on the state Supreme Court.
Aren't there also photographs of him vacationing with a judge who would decide on things involving his mine?
That's right. There was pictures of him on the coast of France. He was vacationing with Spike Maynard, who was a sitting member of the court. They said they were good childhood friends. They didn't plan this trip together. They just happened to run into each other at a resort in the south of France.
Yeah.
And yes, those pictures did a lot of damage to Spike Maynard's reelection campaign. He was not reelected to the state Supreme Court several years later.
And Don Blankenship, again, the CEO of Massey Energy, also flatly doesn't believe in global warming. Again, he's right. But how does that play out, given that he runs a mine?
In January, Don Blankenship faced environmental attorney Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and a very interesting debate. The debate was over mountaintop removal mining. Literally, you blow off the top of the mountain, you scrape up the coal, but in the meantime, you have to do something with all this debris and everything that you've blown up, and you put it over the mountain into gullies and streams and that sort of thing. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. hates mountaintop removal mining. Don Blankenship simply says, look, it's not the United States that's causing this pollution. China and India are causing the pollution. And if it wasn't for all these regulations, we could produce more coal.
So he's been very vocal in that way. Putting aside Don Blankenship, though, the four miners still trapped in his mine. We understand they could be in these refuge chambers, and these are sort of spring-up tents?
These are very new to the mining industry. These were developed after the Sago mine disaster in January 2006. In that particular case, you had 12 men who were trapped inside the mine. They were alive, but over time, before rescuers could get to them, they ran out of oxygen and they died. After that disaster, all these mine safety officials looked around and said, what can we do to provide a refuge? And they came up with these refuge chambers. These are very new, which is essentially like a pop-up tent, but it's in a metal box, and they can inflate what is the chamber itself. They can crawl into there, but nobody really knows if they can hear, once they get into that refuge chamber, can they hear the seismic activity around them?
Well, of course, the family members are hoping that's where these miners are. That's Beth Voorhees of West Virginia Public Radio with the latest on the rescue efforts at the Massey Coal Mine in Montcoal, West Virginia. Beth, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Hearings resume today in Washington to try to get to the bottom of the subprime lending crisis. Tomorrow, two of the biggest names of Wall Street are scheduled to appear before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Charles Prince III, the former CEO of Citigroup, and Robert Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary, but also former top advisor to Citigroup. Citigroup reportedly lost more than any company in history and then received an extraordinary government bailout. But CEO Prince received a bonus of more than $12 million when he was forced out. Former Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan, who was also a former risk officer with the failed subprime lender New Century Financial Corp, opened the hearings today. He admitted last fall that his belief in an unregulated Wall Street was shaken, but today he defended his record as head of the Fed during this heated exchange with Commission Chair Phil Angelides, in which Greenspan insisted he regulated everything he could.
We covered as much as anyone could conceive of.
But if you had adopted those broader rules, the FTC could have enforced them.
No, others could have enforced them. No, we did adopt a whole series of rules.
But as I said, they only covered 1% of the activity. I mean, you know, my view is, and I want to move on to another issue, is you could have, you should have, and you didn't.
David Leonhardt of the New York Times is with us today to parse through this. David, there you have Phil Angelides saying the Fed only regulated 1% of the subprime market. Greenspan saying he didn't have the authority to do more. And further, he said during the hearings it was the government-backed private firms Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that fanned the flames that pushed people into homes they couldn't afford. So your thoughts just on how this is being laid out today.
Well, there are a lot of things to sort through here. I think the important thing to start with is to back up a little bit from all of these questions about what kind of regulations were passed and promulgated and when all that happened, and just say, to what extent did Greenspan get the housing bubble wrong? And the answer to that question is he got it badly, badly wrong. If you go back and look up at his statements about whether it was likely that housing prices not only would fall but could fall, he suggested it was very unlikely that housing prices would fall. For him to now say, well, no one could have foreseen that they would fall by so much, is a little bit tough to accept, because there were a lot of people who did foresee that they would, in fact, be somewhat likely to fall, and he really dismissed that out of hand. And from that came this relatively lax approach to regulation. Yes, the Fed did some things. But Alan Greenspan, at the height of his prestige, had a tremendous bully pulpit, and he really used it to encourage this kind of lending, not to try to restrict it. And so I think when you sort of back out all of the little specifics about, sure, the Fed did crack down in some ways and they didn't crack down on others, that's really the heart of the matter here. At the base of it, Greenspan believed that the market couldn't get this wrong, and we now know he was wrong about that.
Well, and Angelides, as he, I think we heard him say, said that he had internal documents saying the Fed had issued guidance about predatory lending, but and therefore knew about it, but just didn't follow up and regulate it. Let's take a look ahead at tomorrow's hearing, Citibank. Your colleague Andrew Ross Sorkin writes that one of his questions would be, why? Why did someone get a bonus for driving a company into the ground, as the former CEO, Charles Prince III, is said to have done? Would that be one of your questions? And you know, do you think we'll hear that?
My guess is we will. Executive pay is always a popular topic for these sorts of public hearings. I think there are two different things going on with executive pay. Often when you hear about someone who did a terrible job and is fired and gets some huge payday, it is because the company was contractually obligated to give that payday. So the mistake that the company made wasn't when the person was on their way out the door. It was when they came in the door. They essentially agreed to a contract that would pay not only for success but for failure. Then there are times in which we do, in fact, shower people with money when there is discretion, even after they've failed. And that's, both of these are examples of the extent to which a lot of this corporate pay is sort of a rigged game. We have people whose own pay is set by boards, sitting on boards, setting pay of other executives. And I think one of the really important things to keep in mind is that these are incredibly appealing jobs, running one of these companies. And this notion that if we don't give people tens of millions of dollars, even if they fail, we won't be able to find people to do these jobs, is is not particularly credible. And I guess we can hope that in the wake of this crisis, we'll see boards get more serious about how they protect shareholder money. But that's one of these issues that I've become somewhat cynical about.
Well, I want to talk about going forward, but in the meantime, just, there's no incentive for them to. In fact, it seems as if they've even had legal decisions in their favor. I'm talking about the fact that a group of stockholders sued Citigroup's directors over not just the bonus, but some other decisions they made. And the judge at the time dismissed the case. He said boards are protected by something called business judgment rule. Now, we understand lawyers call it the stupidity rule. But what is that?
Well, I mean, what's hard here is that we don't want a situation in which every time shareholders upset about something, they can grind the board's workings to a halt. I mean, I don't know if you've ever attended a shareholder meeting, but they're a little wacky. You know, there are people who get up and read long letters about everything under the sun. And we do need laws in place to make sure that companies can focus on the important things. But on the other hand, the system we have in which we entrust boards to manage shareholders' money responsibly also doesn't seem to be working a little bit in some important ways.
Well, the judge pretty much said that directors have to be able to take risk without this debilitating fear that they're going to be held liable. But, you know, as we've seen, if you can take too much risk and not be held liable, well, the thing falls apart.
Yeah. I mean, that is why, you know, regulating executive pay is incredibly difficult. But I do wonder whether there are some ways to do it better than we've done it. It's not simply the Fed issuing guidelines about best practices. I think that will have relatively little effect. But I do wonder whether there are some ways to either encourage companies to pay more based on long-term performance or have some of these clawback provisions so that if you get a bonus in 2011 for great performance, but then we learn in 2013 that, in fact, it was a mirage, is it easier to go back and get that money? Right now, in most cases, it's quite difficult to do that.
Well, we're coming up on a break in about a minute or so, but we want to talk about, you know, what is being proposed by both the House and the Senate. And are you seeing some of these reforms, you know, yoking pay to performance?
We don't see a lot yet in the pay area. I don't think that should be at the top of our list for what we want to see. I think actually what we should care more about is how big Wall Street is, how much we taxpayers are left to clean up its mess. And then to the extent that Wall Street wants to set its own pay, I'm much more comfortable having Wall Street set its own pay as long as we're not the ones left holding the bag when things go wrong.
Right. Maybe we're looking at the wrong thing. That's David Leonhardt of the New York Times. Well, when we come back, what is happening with reform? Economist Simon Johnson says, in effect, the banks have won. They've won over Washington lawmakers. So we'll see if David's hearing any of these things he wants to hear about ensuring that banks don't get too big. Also later today, that fictional farm from The Office, it's on the map, literally. That's later. Back in 1 minute with David Leonhardt of the New York Times, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been speaking with David Leonhardt, staff writer and economic columnist for the New York Times, about the way forward, really, after the financial collapse. This is on the first day of two hearings by the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission in Washington. It was set up as sort of the 9/11 commission was set up after 9/11 to see what happened. And David, just as we look forward, the House has passed a bill. The Senate is expected to take it up again after their Easter break. What's the fundamental philosophical difference between Republicans and Democrats on the way forward?
I don't even know that we know that completely. I think that the Republicans are trying to figure out a little bit where they are on this. They were much clearer about where they were on health care reform. They were opposed almost no matter what. And I think they're more willing to deal on this for a combination of both philosophical and political reasons. I think one of the concerns that Republicans have traditionally is about any new form of regulation. So you mentioned Fannie and Freddie earlier. I think Fannie and Freddie did play a role in making the housing bubble bigger than it was.
And I should just say, for people who have just joined us, this is Alan Greenspan saying today that he felt that the government-backed private firms, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were the ones that sort of got people to buy into homes that they couldn't afford.
Yeah, and now he's confusing direction and magnitude here. These firms did play a role, but by no means were they the main cause of the housing bubble. I mean, you just have to look at what happened with firms like Lehman Brothers and,
right,
and just generally to know that Fannie and Freddie weren't the main thing going on. But it's true that they were a problem. And so I think there's a concern among Republicans that if you set up a new consumer financial agency that they may create more problems in the future with regulation. They may direct banks not to do or to do certain things that will distort the market and create problems. Republicans are also traditionally closer to Wall Street, and so you would imagine in some ways that they are reflecting what Wall Street is worried about in this regulation more than Democrats are.
Well, just a quick question, because we're reading that, as you said, Republicans are sort of against the bank bailouts and the spending of money, but also against reform. Now, the preponderance of opinion from economists was that the bailouts saved the economy, however odious they were. So do the Republicans, in effect, get to, you know, gin up anger about bank bailouts while keeping reform that led to the bailouts from happening?
That politically, that is clearly part of the strategy. There's this memo from Frank Luntz, a Republican pollster, that's got some attention that basically spelled out a strategy that could fairly be described the way you just described it. There is an honest free market position that basically says we shouldn't bail these banks out. If we don't bail them out, then shareholders will be more vigilant, and we will not have nearly as many problems because shareholders will be on the watch for them. The problem with that position is that it is ahistorical. We do bail banks out because when we have decided not to bail them out, the famous liquidate, liquidate, liquidate policy of Treasury Secretary Mellon in the 20s and 30s, we've had enormous, terrible financial crises and recessions and even depression. And so this notion that just after bailing all these banks out, done by a Republican administration and a Democratic Congress, somehow we could say, oh, you know what, really there'll be no more bailouts in the future, that's just not credible. And so what we need to then do is regulate banks more closely, much as we did for the decades after World War II, so that bailouts are less likely in the future.
Well, let's talk. Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to talk about some of the things that you say have to be in the regulations, you and others. Financial firms have to be forced to have more capital on hand, and not just capital, but liquid capital, stuff they can spend right away. But then doesn't the problem become if they, the more cash that they have to hold in reserve, the less they're lending out?
Well, to some extent, that's true. The more cash they're holding in reserve, the less they're lending out. And clearly, the more cash they're holding, the less profit they make, right? I mean, you think about a homeowner. If you put just 5% down on a house and then the house goes up 5% in value, you've doubled your investment. Whereas if you're forced to put 20% down on the house and the house goes up 5% in value, you've made only a 25% return on your investment. So clearly, holding more capital hurts profits. But I'm not that worried that if we force banks to hold more capital, we'll suddenly have an absence, a lack of loans in our economy. I mean, credit is pretty widely available in today's global economy. It's fairly inexpensive.
Well, then a lot of small businesses would debate that. They say they're not getting money from banks because banks are waiting to hear how much money they're going to have to hold on to.
Oh, absolutely. Right now there is a little bit of a credit crunch, but we're still in the wake of the worst financial crisis in 70, 80 years. And so it's not that we want to force banks to hold more money today. It's that over the long term, when the next boom comes around, we want to force them to hold money, more money than they did during the last boom.
That's David Leonhardt of the New York Times. David, I hate to do this to you because we've got about a minute and a half. We've just been checking in with you. But can you, in a minute and a half, tell me, you say the biggest thing is how to keep banks from getting too big. Can you, in a minute and a half, just tell me what you would like to see?
Yeah, so for me, it's not individual banks. You mentioned Simon Johnson, and some people are really worried about the size of individual banks. I think that's secondary. If you look at the banks that collapsed and caused huge problems the last time around, some of them, like Lehman, were by no means our biggest financial institutions. And so what I care much more about is the overall size of Wall Street as a sector. I think it got too big. It came to make up 40% of corporate profits in our economy. It came to attract many of the best human resources, right? The top college graduates, scientists, mathematicians, doctors, former government officials, the most desirable employees out there. And we later found out that a lot of the profits they were making were ephemeral. And so we don't want to have that happen again. And the reason it happened is this sort of implicit government backstop. And the way you deal with something like that is you tax it. And so I think really the best strategy going forward is to have a tax on finance that basically says, look, we acknowledge we're going to bail you out if there's a future problem. There's no way around that. And as a result, we're going to force you to pay for that tax in advance, that bailout, by taxing you. So that, to me, these sorts of taxes that you hear talked about globally and in the U.S. Are probably the most promising thing, along with capital requirements.
David Leonhardt, again in the New York Times, always leaving us with a provocative thought, and you know we'll pick it up again. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, just taking the temperature there. Back after the news here and now. Even before President Obama signed health care reform into law, states were gearing up to fight it. As we've reported, 15 state attorneys general are challenging the new law. Six of those AGs get a big amount of their campaign donations from the health care industry, and health care groups are expected to play a big role in upcoming gubernatorial and congressional races. Frederica Scouten is following the money trail for USA Today. Frederica, 15 attorneys general involved in fighting health care reform. How much money did they get from healthcare interests compared to other AGs?
Well, overall, individuals and companies with a stake in healthcare gave $3.2 million to all sitting AGs in the last several years. And nearly half of that, $1.5 million, went to those involved in the lawsuits.
Well, one of the attorneys general, Texas, is Greg Abbott. He received the most from healthcare groups. More than $415,000 in his 2006 campaign.
Right.
But what does his office say to you about that money?
The argument that they make is that there is no connection between campaign contributions and official actions. In fact, Jason Johnson, who is a spokesman for his campaign, said, look, we know that healthcare interests stand to make a lot more money because of the healthcare overhaul that passed Congress. After all, there are going to be far more people covered, and so therefore drug companies and health insurance companies will make more money. So if anything, they should be asking us for refunds. That's what we hear consistently when we talk to people about this, is that there's no connection between actions and campaign contributions. The point that we make when we're taking a look at this money is that it's clear that healthcare interests have been invested for a long time in state races, and I tend to look at federal campaign contributions and lobbying efforts, and it's time that we take a more deeper look at what happens at the state level, because a lot of elements of this law are going to play out in states for years to come.
Well, and how much more will they play out now that the Supreme Court has decided that under their First Amendment freedom of speech rights, corporations and unions can spend freely on political ads for or against specific candidates?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's a big question. The groups who are very concerned about campaign spending are deeply concerned that corporations will spend heavily, and particularly at the state and local level, where it doesn't take an enormous amount of money to influence the state Senate, or in some cases, judicial races as well. Organizations have been free to spend a lot more heavily. There is a growing sense among the experts that it perhaps won't be individual corporations. Pick, you know, Corporation X that makes, you know, soap, won't necessarily put money into a race and encourage people to vote against a sitting governor, because after all, it could offend shareholders and customers. But if you want to make your views known, you can do so through a third-party organization, a chamber or a nonprofit that does not have to disclose its donors.
Well, since the Supreme Court made this ruling that frees up corporations to spend more money on campaigns, we understand that some states have been looking for ways to put restrictions on or add transparency to the process. Tell us about that.
there are a number of states that are trying to sort of impose some restrictions around the edges on it, saying, for instance, well, if a corporation decides to spend money in a political way, we think the corporation ought to get prior approval from its shareholders before making that sort of expenditure. A number of states, and there is legislation being contemplated at the federal level, would also really beef up the disclosure requirements. In the Supreme Court case, Citizens United, the justices very strongly stood behind the notion that the public needed to know where the money was coming from. And so a lot of legislators feel as though they are on safe ground constitutionally to increase the disclosure. So if there is an ad that says, you know, vote against X or Senator so-and-so is in the wrong direction, give him a call, that at least the public has a better sense of the source of that funding.
That's Frederica Skouten of USA Today, following the money trail from the healthcare industry to candidates. Frederica, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
A quick reminder while we have the time, you can always listen to our show stream live at hereandnow.org. You can download a podcast, take us with you wherever you go, and you can follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. Okay, I've covered all bases. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Schrute Farms, a combination beet farm and agritourism destination outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania, has received over 700 reviews on TripAdvisor.com. That's the website that provides travel recommendations. Here's one. The informative lecture satisfies all your beet curiosity. The Dawn Goose Walk will tug at your heart. Proprietor Dwight Schrute reacts to the site.
TripAdvisor is the lifeblood of the agritourism industry. A couple of bad reviews there, you may as well close up shop. That's what took down the Stalk Inn, one of the cutest little asparagus farms you'll ever see.
But Dwight did get some negative reviews. One woman writes, I would leave any preconceptions at home. Also, leave any jewelry, cash, or cats. They tend to steal the former and kill the latter. Wait a minute. Who do we know that killed a cat? Why, that's Dwight Schrute from the TV show The Office. The farm is the fictional home of Dwight, the survivalist paper salesman, and now hotelier.
Here we are, irrigation room, very special room. So I'll come get you before the table-making demonstration. And as of this morning, we are completely wireless here at Schrute Farms. But as soon as I find out where Moe's hid all the wires, we'll get that power back on. Alrighty.
Christine Peterson is the marketing officer of TripAdvisor.com. She joins us from their London offices. Christine, how did this work? I mean, we hear Dwight Schrute on The Office referring to TripAdvisor. Was that product placement, or did the reviews come naturally? What happened?
The folks at NBC called us after they had developed the script for the show. Said, hey, we want to run this by you. Okay with you? And of course, we were thrilled. We don't have a huge marketing budget. We okayed the script, and then we were off and running, and we just were waiting to see what everyone else was going to see when the show aired.
So does any money exchange hands with you and NBC's The Office?
Not at all. Nope.
It's just free advertising for both of you.
Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
So did you put Schrute Farms on TripAdvisor, or did people start reviewing it themselves?
In terms of a listing, we put it on the site, but then we sat back and waited. And, you know, we put a couple of reviews on it first just to make sure it was functioning correctly. And then once it aired, that was when really the floodgates opened and the reviews started coming in. And as you said, today we've got over 725 reviews and 325 photos and videos that go along with the farm.
Well, tell us some of the pictures.
They're hysterical. I mean, obviously a lot of them are photoshopped and, you know, otherwise, but showing real people standing out in the farm next to Dwight. Some wonderful shots just of the beets themselves. I think my favorite is I believe it's waffles for breakfast covered with whipped cream and then topped with beets. Really, well, really delicious looking.
Well, and for those who didn't see the episode where the couple from The Office, Jim and Pam, go to stay at Schrute Farm, it's a sort of gothic deliverance kind of feeling to it. It's really kind of scary. There are many ways to have borscht there. But do you get people, reviewers, who don't know it's a joke? Are they actually looking for Schrute Farms?
We didn't think so until we actually got a complaint from a real traveler who was on TripAdvisor and claimed that they tried to book Schrute Farms and didn't realize that, you know, it wasn't true. So we actually now have a we have a sign next to the page on TripAdvisor that says this place is actually fictional. We warn the occasional traveler away that you can't actually book, you can't stay here. It's all just for fun, and it's tied into the television show. Actually, we were sending out some information about the Shroot Farms page last week to all TripAdvisor employees, and we did get someone who wrote back and said, actually, my wife is a big farm visitor, and she was very disappointed to find out that Shroot Farms did not exist. So it's actually employees who were causing us to put the sign up on the site saying, no, you actually can't go here.
Well, what a shame, because in addition to all the tasty beet dishes, one reviewer writes, there's free use of paintball guns and potato rifles, unexpected fun. Just be warned, the owner thinks he's a deputy sheriff and will watch him very closely. Christine Peterson, the marketing officer of TripAdvisor.com. The fictional Shroot Farm is wildly popular on the site. Christine, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
And now to real travel and leisure. For years, the cafe has been part of the French lifestyle, and many a trip to Paris required a daily trip to one. But local cafes are now becoming an endangered species. At least two go out of business every day. The BBC's David Chazan reports.
I'm in Fontenay-Saint-Père, which is a village of stone houses surrounded by fields, a couple of hours' drive from Paris. And I'm going into the last surviving cafe here. It's been here for 100 years, and it's got an old-style wooden bar. This morning it's quite busy, but the owner, Valérie Letouzet, says he's getting fewer customers. He's struggling to pay his bills, the banks won't lend him any more money, so he's appealing for contributions from local people to try to keep this cafe open, and so far he's raised more than 2,000 euros.
Les cafés de village ne sont plus des endroits fréquentés, ne sont pas des endroits à la mode.
Cafés, village cafés aren't in fashion these days. And there's the bad economic situation and the smoking ban. And tradesmen are struggling because of social charges, which are far too high.
Last year, 2,000 cafés went out of business in the Paris area alone. Those in villages are even worse affected. There's high unemployment and farmers aren't doing too well. But for many locals in Fontenay, the cafe is vital.
It's really important for this village because the cafe is the spirit, the center of the village. The same thing that pub in London.
It's a place where we can meet people after work, and without this cafe, it will be very sad here. You have always someone to speak here, even the Sunday afternoon.
I've come to a busy cafe in the heart of Paris. It's famous because it was used as the set for part of the film Amélie. It's got a beautiful old-style zinc bar and lots of mirrors. It's full of office workers having lunch, and there are also a few tourists. But even so, the owner, Marc Fougedoir, says times are tough.
The seuil de rentabilité.
It's getting harder for cafe to make a profit because charges and overheads like rent are increasing, but the number of customers isn't going up.
Half the population of France lives on 1,500 euros a month or less, but Marc Fougedoir says if traditional cafes are losing business, it's also because tastes and lifestyles are changing.
It's not just a question of prices, but what we offer. Look at Starbucks. Coffee is expensive, but they do very good business. They've succeeded in taking a simple thing like coffee and making it sophisticated, and they've been able to market it the way only the Americans know how.
Back in the village cafe, local musicians are holding a concert to try to raise funds to keep the place open. But cafes aren't alone in France in being affected by globalization. As you can hear, they're singing in English.
Mon Dieu, the BBC's David Chazan in Paris. Back in a minute with the wake left by murder, here and now. What happens after a hideous crime? That's the question that Randi Susan Myers explores in her debut novel, The Murderer's Daughters, a book that begins in the 70s with Lulu telling what happened just a day before her 9th birthday.
I wasn't surprised when Mama asked me to save her life. By my first week in kindergarten, I knew she was no macaroni necklace-wearing kind of mother. Essentially, Mama regarded me as a miniature hand servant. Grab me a Pepsi, Lulu. Get the milk for your sister's cereal. Go to the store and buy me a pack of Winston's. Then, one day, she upped the stakes. Don't let Daddy in the apartment.
Lulu and her little sister Mary always do what they're told so as not to provoke their violent father or their self-involved mother. But on this day, she does let her drunken dad into the apartment, then runs to get help when he stabs her mother, and comes back to find her mother dead, her sister wounded. After their father is sent to prison, Lulu and Mary are branded the murderer's daughters, first by their mother's relatives who refuse to take them in, then by schoolmates at a Dickensian orphanage they're sent to, then on some deep level by themselves, no matter how successful they become in their own lives. The Los Angeles Times calls The Murderer's Daughters one of the knockout debuts of 2010, and author Randy Susan Myers joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you. It's really great to be here, Robin.
Well, it's a great but difficult read. I understand it comes from a personal storyline of your own.
It does. This book came from three places, and one of them is having spent the past 10 years before the last couple of years working with batterers and getting upset when I would ask the guys, which I always did, so where were your kids during the violence in your home? They'd always say the same thing. The kids were sleeping. No, the kids were never sleeping.
Because you knew they weren't sleeping. You knew they heard because you were one of them.
Yes, my household was very noisy and very intense. And the biographical part of this book is the first chapter, which, in fact, I don't remember. I was 4 years old. My sister was seven. And it's a story my sister has told me about when she let my father in the house and he tried to kill my mother. Now, he didn't succeed. My mother did live to be 80 years old. But the rest of the book, after that first chapter, is a huge what if. What if he had killed her?
Well, and domestic violence does end in murder many times, but more often it doesn't. And so there are, I'm guessing, a lot of kids and now adults in America walking around with that same question in their heads. What if?
It's exactly what's going on out there. I worked with men who had so many children, and every time you read about a domestic violence dispute, it talks about so-and-so and so-and-so had three children, and that's all you ever hear. And I think in our minds we totally dismiss the kids as sleeping, because as a society, we too want to believe they're sleeping because it makes us feel more comfortable. If we realized the kids were listening to all this, we'd get very uncomfortable.
Yeah, and as you show with Lulu and Mary, not only listening to it, but choreographing their every move so as not to provoke it.
That is one of the things that children and anybody who's in an abusive relationship goes through, is that walking on eggshells constantly. Children from any sort of traumatic home, whether it be alcohol abuse, drug abuse, screaming, yelling, violence, or murder, are hypervigilant.
Yeah.
They know from the minute their mother or father walk in the house, or their husband, exactly what their mood is.
Yeah.
They smell it.
Well, and as you said, you grew up with this. You eventually became a professional working with people who were violent, working with batterers. Your character, Mary, the youngest daughter of the two, becomes a parole officer. Just stay on that for a second. Is that common, you know, people trying to heal in perfect strangers what they couldn't heal in their family?
Oh, it is so common. And having worked in human services and social services for so long, it's not completely like this, but very often when people have experienced abuse, they either become very strong at the broken places and often will try to heal through going into that sort of work, or they will become really screwed up themselves.
Well, and that's what we have here, Lulu and Mary. Again, Lulu, the older sister, who always blames herself, although she keeps it shoved in the back of her mind, for opening that apartment door, letting her father in. She goes on to become a doctor. She's going to save other people. Mary, who can't believe that her father would have stabbed her too, which he did, clings to an idealized version of her father. She visits him in prison. So you've got these two different ways that they seem to react to the event. Lulu marries a great guy, has two children. Mary has meaningless relationships and has to move in and out with her sister. They both seem to be having these different reactions, but in effect, they both have been affected in the same way.
One of the things that I find very fascinating about families, and this goes beyond whether you're in a family where there's abuse or not, is how you can have sisters, brothers, any sort of siblings grow up with the same mom, the same dad, and when they talk about something in the past, they might as well have been in different homes. No, dad didn't do that. No, mom didn't do that. And that, in fact, is what happens to Lulu and Mary. They come through the same event and react totally differently. One, Lulu is trying to control her sister to act as she is, and Mary is begging for help in what she thinks is managing her father.
Right, and even though Lulu is cutting off all ties with her father, telling Mary we got to move on, and becoming a doctor, she has a moment where she absolutely falls apart when she sees a horrific knife victim come in to the emergency room. It's there. It's just underneath.
It's always there. And I think often we have these incredibly entwined relationships with our siblings where we're so close and yet struggle against each other in the same way, that push and pull that goes on. And I found myself writing about the love between Lulu and Mary as much as I was writing about anything else.
Yeah, and since you do have a sister who is the one who told you what really happened when
exactly.
you were younger, what do you take from that obviously loving relationship? Was there a resistance on someone's behalf? You don't want to hear it. I mean, tell me more about that push me, pull you kind of relationship between siblings.
When we were younger, she had to look out for me an awful lot, sort of like Lulu looked out for Mary. Even though she's only a little over 3 years older than me, she did have to take care of me even in as much as cooking for me. When we got older and started actually talking to each other, and we are like the best of friends now, it was that experience where I remembered nothing bad about my father, and she remembered only bad about my father. And in fact, like many abusive men, my father could be very charming, and this has been borne out by other family members. He could either be very depressed and violent and crazy when he was high, or he could be really charming. And I remember the charm, and my sister remembers the violence. He died when we were quite young, so yeah. Our memories are childhood impacted all the way.
In your acknowledgments, you say that this book is for children of men you work with, men who destroy their families, who weren't monsters but did monstrous things. In effect, so then it's for you, the book.
I think the best of books take the emotional truth inside an author and really blow it up. So although after the first chapter, there's nothing that I can say is I wasn't in an orphanage, I didn't have a foster mother, I wasn't a probation officer or a doctor, I think I took the emotional truth and really had to sort of open up a vein or two. And in that much, it becomes your book, and then it becomes, I hope, a book that offers a pop of recognition to readers.
Yeah. That's Randi Susan Myers. Her new novel is The Murderer's Daughters. Randi, thanks so much.
Robin, thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.